It's Thursday, December 17th, 2009, and you're listening to episode 173 of Fear the Boot, a show about tabletop role-playing games and a little bit more. Running time for this episode is 52 minutes. Welcome to Fear the Boot. My name is Dan.
This is Wayne.
My name is James.
And I'm Michael.
And my name is Nathaniel.
To explain real quick what we're doing with this show, we talked about doing this several episodes back, and now we are actually giving it a shot to see how it goes. We are doing a live-action role-play roundtable. A couple of us have played in some LARPs, but none of us really felt qualified enough to talk about the diverse offerings of the hobby. So what we did was we grabbed some people that have some fairly diverse skill sets and ask them to come on the show to talk about this subject. And we're going to see how long this goes. If it goes over, we'll just break the show in half or in over 2 weeks. If we get it all in an hour, then that's fine too. Two announcements real quick before I get to the three gentlemen that have joined us. First off, for anyone who didn't notice, in episode 172, we've experimented with adding timestamps to our topics.
I've seen a lot of good feedback already just from that.
Yeah, and I don't know we're going to be able to do it in every show simply because a lot of times we start and stop topics or intermix topics. But I know there are people out there that maybe want to skip a portion of the conversation or skip back to and review a portion of the conversation. So if you go out and look at the show notes, I will try to keep including timestamps whenever we change subject. So that should help you guys out there. The second thing is Fear the Con 3 sign-up is on its way. It's not ready yet, but we have set a deadline that if we don't have our new solution ready, we'll be going back to Warhorns. So one way or another, as of January 1st, you guys will be able to do ticketing and event sign-up for Fear the Con 3. So just stay tuned and we'll give you the details on that as it hits.
You should also, over the next week or so, as right around Christmas, start seeing some of the flyers come out if you're in this area. A couple of us are going to be traveling, want to make sure we have flyers set up in some other local cities as well. Just to get it out, get everyone, you know, on the same page that this is coming and we're all excited about it.
So let's get to the real subject at hand here, which is live action role play. I'd like to start by giving these three gentlemen a chance to explain who they are and what they do. So James, we'll start with you. What is your background experience with LARPing?
Well, I got my start in LARP, as many people did, with playing Vampire. It's been about 10 years now, I suppose. And started by playing and branched off, did a bit of narration, and at some point we splintered off and started our own game, and that went on for a couple of years. Then I took a bit of a break, got into theater, and I've been doing that for a while, and last few years I've been building live-action games from scratch and just sort of incorporating a bit more of a theatrical bent and also some of the stuff that I learned from the SCA and sort of taking it from that way.
Michael, what about you?
I was a teenager, about 14 or 15 in the SCA, and played around for a few years, never really got fully into it, just went to a few big events. From there, I went into more foam combat because it's fast-paced and, frankly, it's cheaper. Derek here, Belgarf, both very similar. For the last several years, I've been playing Amped Guard and have been known to go over to SCA and Nero events in the meantime.
Nathaniel, what about you?
I got started, I must have been maybe 12 or 13, and I was introduced to it by some friends who were already into it, and they had been doing, you know, the live role-playing for a good few years by that point. We had a local club where, you know, basically kids go, you know, crawl through labyrinths in you know, their custom complex and hit people dressed up as monsters with foam weapons. Took a break for a few years after only doing it for a very short time, and got back into it, you know, maybe when I was 15, 16, doing some, you know, weekend events, and then got into the Vampire Masquerade stuff for a while, burned out on that after a few years, and then just got back into the good old-fashioned things with swords and hitting them, and yeah, haven't really looked back.
You know, Dan, hearing these resumes, I don't know how I never got into LARPing. I'm walking around with custom-fitted fangs. No one approaches me about Vampire. I'm sword fighting with glow-in-the-dark swords in complete dark in stores, but no one ever approached me about any of this stuff. I would have probably gotten a huge kick out of this years ago. It just seems like a no-brainer to me.
Well, it's never too late to start, Wayne.
That's definitely one of the subjects I want to come back to here as we're talking, is the what seems to me like an insular nature of LARP. And I'm curious what these guys have to say about that. But first, real quick, and I want to spend a lot of time on this because I think we could get caught up in irrelevant semantics, but I want to talk a little bit about what do you guys think separates live-action role-playing from a tabletop role-playing game. For example, if you have a tabletop role-playing game, you talk in character a lot, maybe you stand up and act some scenes out, but you still have that tabletop you return to, you still have some dice you throw. Is that to you guys a LARP? Or if not, where is that jumping off point where you think live-action role-play begins?
I think that something that sort of defines live-action role-play is, to a greater extent, the amount of immersion that's possible, because, you know, all your NPCs they're not disappearing. You can sort of visually see everything. And, of course, the action part. You're up, you're moving, you're walking around. Yes, you can do that with sit-down, absolutely. But if we are semantically defining it, I think that would have to be one of the major points.
In addition to that, I think that it's a lot more hands-on. In a tabletop game, you can only voice act so much, describe so much. But in real life, a LARP, you can actually walk up to the big hairy dude holding a broad axe and talk to him. You can actually fight the goblins. You can do all that stuff that the GM has to describe just and passively notice all of this. And just the immersion adds a whole other level of it.
Well, I see the immersion, but I'm kind of curious. When I've heard the stories of what, say, Vampire is like, it doesn't seem like there's a lot of action going on there. There's definitely the immersion factor that's stronger than I've seen elsewhere, but I don't see a lot of the action there.
Well, I think perhaps if you're hunched over a table, whispering between your clan mates, and you're trying not to let people listen, and you're there, and I think just being in the costume and being with all these other people, that's what thrusts you into it. Even though I know there's no action, there's no fighting per se, but like I said, if you're sort of grouped around a table, you're sort of looking around nervously, hoping no one's going to notice you there, you don't do that in a tabletop game.
Can I just bring up a distinction that I know in the UK at least, there's been a bit of a, I wouldn't so much call it an argument as just two sides of a coin, where we've always called it LARP, where it stands for live roleplay. There's been no A in that. It's been LRP, live roleplay, because the action is almost incidental. Ultimately, what it comes down to is, can you do it and feel like you're being awesome? You know, you can't really sit around a table, just stare somebody down, who's another player, potentially, and just feel like you have won that through force of will. Because when you're sitting around a table, everything is based on the stats that you've got on your sheet. And some dice rolls, rather than you projecting yourself in a physical manner.
Do you typically still have any out-of-character interactions, or is everything you do in character then? Because that could be a dividing line as well.
It all depends on the game, and it's largely to do with the complexity of their rule systems. You know, in a well-designed system, that's dependent on the setting. So some of them, there are no out-of-character actions, although you'd be hard-pressed to, you know, find a sizable game where there's no out-of-character actions, because players are generally there to have fun. And it's not so much fun if you can't take 5 minutes to talk to your friends and go, that was awesome.
You probably have some variety within the groups as well. I mean, I've never done a LARP, but I have done multiple murder mystery dinners. And to me, they seem to be a lot of in the same vein. And when you go, you'll see the people that are just being themselves, that are just there trying to solve the mystery. And then you get the people that are completely in character from beginning to end. They're given their character at the beginning, and that's what they'll be throughout the night. I have to admit, I tend to fall on that side of really trying to get into it and get into the immersion factor. So I can imagine you probably have something like that here, too, where some people are more in character than others.
Definitely. And also, in a lot of games, there are out-of-character zones. So that if you do need to sort of get your brain straight, you can tuck yourself off in a corner and you're not going to ruin anybody else's immersion.
That is interesting. I had never heard of that before.
Is that common?
That seems to be the general rule in pretty much any game that you go to. If you can be out of character as long as you're out of the way and not interfering with other people who are in character.
So, for example, let's say we're doing a fantasy LARP and we're out in the woods doing whatever, but I have to have a phone on me because I've got a sick kid at home. The phone rings. There's a place I'm supposed to step off to take that. Is that kind of how it works?
That would be the civilized thing to do.
Yeah, no one's going to complain about the fact that you've had to take a phone call, because that would be them being being a bit of a, well, I don't know what your language level is here, but them being a bit of a dick.
Yeah.
And in the UK, at least, we've got it's a fairly universal rule, which we call Rule 7, which is essentially don't take the piss. If someone needs to take a phone call, they need to take a phone call. You know, it might ruin your immersion for 20 seconds, but that's 20 seconds. They're going to take a phone call. They're not going to stand there and stay within earshot whilst they're taking their phone call. But because it's quite a friendly community, you know, for the most part, no one's really going to mind.
Something I don't want to dwell on at length, but I think we ought to talk about at least briefly, if nothing else, just to give you guys a fair chance to respond to it, is the negative stereotypes that are associated with LARPers. I was talking to James about this last night, and we were describing, I guess, a geek bigotry or a nerd bigotry.
Yeah.
As role players, we understand when we watch something like Scared of Girls that that guy exists, but the majority of role players are not that guy. But I don't know if that same understanding exists with LARPers. It seems like a lot of us, we watch the Lightning Bolt video, or in my case, we have the run-in with the Dark Lord of Denny's, and there's a presumption that's what LARPing is. And James, I want to start this with you because you had a thought on this last night that I found fascinating.
Basically, I don't think that LARP is particularly flattering when it's shown on video. I think if you're going to show it in a medium, I find that stills and written usually are the better ways to go. And I think that perhaps what it is we have come accustomed to such, you know, lush visual graphics and these great production values when it comes to video and media, that you see a LARP video, and I'm not talking about the trailers because there's some pretty cool trailers out there, but video of actual footage, it really does fall flat on its face. I mean, and that and the intensity that you're feeling playing the game, you are willing to allow yourself to forget a lot of the things that people can't do if they're watching from the outside.
That's exactly the same reasons why gaming stories don't work. You're getting it secondhand. When you're watching a video, you're not there getting the feel of the forest, getting the background music of whatever bard is playing a flute, and the visceral sensation of it all. You're getting it through a 42-inch TV screen.
Plus, most role players, despite what some of them may think, not that great actors.
It struck me as I was thinking about this that I guess kind of as you guys are describing, maybe incorrect by wording here if you disagree with it, but it's an immersion issue. As I read a novel, I tend to see a movie in my head. As I'm playing a role-playing game, I get caught up where I start picturing the scene. I start hearing the sounds. I kind of get taken there in a certain
Definitely.
Sense. And with a LARP, I'm sure the same sort of thing is going on. Except now if you try to put it in video format and take it out there, here I am sitting at home watching YouTube. I have none of that immersion. And quite frankly, everyone just looks silly.
Yes, unfortunately, that can be the case. I can't see of any way that video can really make LARP look good unless it's done by people who are pretty much actor type people. And they're maybe setting a scene or doing a LARP trailer to sort of show what's out there.
Yeah, there's several problems with doing a video, and one of those is that even if you were to film real-life people doing real-life stuff, you know, they're not acting, they're just going about their daily business. When you watch that on video, yeah, unless the people making that video are professional documentary makers, it's unlikely to actually look very real either, because life does not translate well to video. So when you've got something that isn't even real in the first place, you've got that extra level of disassociation, you know, it's been abstracted one level further.
There's another issue that kind of goes hand in hand with this I'd like to talk about, which is as a tabletop role player, I role play at a table in somebody's house, maybe once in a blue moon at a gaming store or at a gaming con, but it's always at an isolated singular location. Whereas with LARPs, and I'm sure this is not true of all of them, but there are certainly a percentage of them that get a kick out of freaking the mundane, out of breaking those boundaries, being out in public, being up in your face, maybe even dragging people into the game. Is that common? Is that just an obnoxious minority?
I think it's definitely an obnoxious minority, but unfortunately, they're not good ambassadors for the game, and bad minority, unfortunately, I think ruins it for a lot of players who just want to have a bit of fun and get along with everybody else.
Yeah, obnoxious minority.
I've always wondered if it's also part of this slippery slope argument of when you feel you're outside the norm, you want to point to someone else and say, well, at least I'm not going that far. And if there's a loud, obnoxious person there of any nature, you can at least point to them and say, well, I'm not that guy, at least.
The football fan's not the role player. The role player is not the LARPer. The LARPer's not the furry.
Yep.
The furry's not the fanfic writer. It just goes on down.
Yeah, the thing is, though, you get these obnoxious sort of subgroup within any community. Your football fans, for example, you get the obnoxious football fans, but not all football fans, by any stretch of the imagination, are anywhere near as obnoxious. In fact, most of them are thoroughly pleasant people who you'd quite enjoy sitting down and having a chat with.
And I think therein lies part of the problem, is that most people have a lot of exposure to sports. And so when there's an act of violence related to sports, most people understand that was a crazy individual who brought a problem into the game. They were not driven insane by football or hockey or baseball or basketball. This was someone who already had an issue and came to the game with a gun or a pipe or whatever, and something happened. But when people look at role players, the average person on the street looks at a role player, they're not as familiar with what they do. So they hear that story about people killing each other in steam tunnels, and presume it must have been the hobby that caused that. And I think in turn, role players may turn around and do that to LARPers, say, mm-hmm. you know, we've heard these extreme stories, or maybe even had these run-ins with that obnoxious minority, or the people that I believe was James described as not good ambassadors for the hobby. But since we don't have a really intimate understanding of LARP culture, we just presume that must be normative for all of them.
Yeah, and it makes no sense when you look at it, because things like murder mystery dinners are considered mainstream. Every character in Star Trek The Next Generation was a LARPer. That's what the holodeck is the ultimate LARP tool, and that's completely accepted, but this isn't.
Yeah, I'm sure these bad ambassadors, they look at that and go, at least we're not Trekkies, because... They'll always find somebody who they think, oh, at least we're not them.
We may be doing this, but we're not doing it in Klingon.
Yeah, and the people who are doing it in Klingon have somebody else who equally as ridiculous to look down upon.
Here's a question I have for you guys, because this was something that confused me a little bit after we did an episode a while back where I talked briefly about LARPing, and several people wrote in to say, no, that's not what it's like. There's more resources than you're aware of. There's more going on than you're aware of. But here's kind of what occurred to me. I have been in gaming since 1988. I have been doing an RPG podcast since May of 2006. So I'm about 3.5 years now. I go to game shops. I go to conventions. I'm on a first name basis with a bunch of the White Wolf staff. When I go to convention, I tend to seek them out, because there are people there that I know and have interacted with many times before. And yet, after doing all of that, the image I used when I was talking to James last night, so I said, it's like I'm a man who built my house on the train tracks, and yet I've never seen a train.
And I'm walking those trains with fangs and no one's approaching. Maybe that's why no one's approaching me.
But why is that? Because it seems like within tabletop gaming, there is this real zeal for proselytizing the hobby, that people want to draw other people in, to give them a taste of it. Yet here I am, a broad target for a LARP. And in all those years and in all those places, I see nothing. Nobody approaches me. I never catch a book on the shelf. I never get invited to a club. And from talking to other role players, they've had similar experiences.
Oh, I've actually looked at this myself, because it's something of an interest here. It's a twofold issue. One, there's not really that many books, because most people who play it are going to be playing it as part of a system where it's being sold as a service, it's a gaming as a service. And the other part of it is that we're not a great community at recruiting.
Gaming as a service?
Gaming as a service, yes.
Yeah, could you touch on that a little bit?
Okay, gaming as a service, other people will call it different things. I mean, that's simply because I've got a professional background where I deal a lot with software and computers, so that's where how I look at it. It's basically you pay your money to attend events. The rules are free because they're pretty much an open source games design, essentially, because they've grown organically from one system which has taken bits and pieces of other systems that they'd like, and they've incorporated them as best they can to fit what their needs are. There's no way that they can sell these rule books, and to be honest, players, at least in the UK, I can't speak for anywhere else, but in the UK, they're not overly interested in buying books for these systems because the rules are very much fluid. They change periodically, much like software does. So it's like basically you're paying for your MMO. So instead of putting down your, $15 in the US for a monthly subscription to World of Warcraft, you put down your, let's say, depending on the event, your 30 quid for your weekend. And then your next weekend will be another 30 quid. And what that's paying for is for the hiring of the event site, the cost of hiring facilities as and when, and the larger the sites are, the more expensive they are, but conversely got potentially much larger player base, so you get the economy of scale.
That is a really interesting concept, a LARP as an MMO, only you are your avatar.
I'm curious about a comment you made a little bit further back where you said something to the effect of LARPers are not good recruiters. Why is that?
Part of it is that there's a bit of snobbery. They don't want to deal with the kids, and that's really where you have to recruit from. A lot of them, they do not want to deal with children because they're playing games that are rather, well, not adult-themed. I don't mean, that there's nudity or anything like that. Most games stand for that, but there's, horror, there's death, there's murder. There's some pretty rough stuff that can happen in these games when two sets of, individuals with wild imaginations square off against each other in a in an environment where there's no real consequences to themselves, just to these imaginary characters. Things can get pretty extreme. So there's a bit of that. They don't want to have to step away from that. And on the other hand, you've got a lot of these players have been in the hobby for many, many years. And they've moved on from these small scale little things, which is what people have to start with. And they don't really want to go back to that. I mean, I sort of have the analogy of the car. It's great if you want to drive your Rolls Royce. You've been doing this many years, you can now afford to attend the Rolls Royce of nothing. But there's still a need for your small little runabout cars, the first car people get, that sort of thing. Except that because most of the people who are already in the hobby are going for the Rolls Royce end of the game, there's no real benefits in many event organizers' eyes, running the small scale stuff because it's small scale. That makes it very difficult to entice new people in outside of universities.
I have a different problem in our organizations that I've seen. Mostly it comes down to people don't want to look silly and they want to look normal. What I mean by that is a lot of people are scared to approach the people wearing the big baggy clothing, hitting people with foam sticks, looking silly in the local park. They don't really want to look out of place. A big issue with newcomers is wearing their garb in public before and after events. I guess people just, they're shy about it. They don't want people to think that they're silly.
I've seen that just with Renaissance fairs. I've got a cloak and a few other things, and I don't put them on until the gas station right before the Renaissance fair.
Yeah.
I completely understand that.
On the flip side, it's somewhat valid because even if I'm going to a LARP event in another state, I won't even bring any what people call mundane clothing, normal clothing, along. I'll dress in my LARP garb for the road trip over there, even if I'm not going to fight that day, just because I'm getting into the mood of it. And there was one time where I was in a store and I was dressed up with a couple friends of mine at the checkout line. And a small child behind us was commenting on how we were dressed. And the mom, shushed him and said, "Shh, it's religion."
Well, I'm curious what religion that would be.
I don't know. People see baggy clothing with a big foam sword tied to their hip and they think I might offend them. So
I didn't know if there was like an Amish the Furnituring LARP or what.
I wonder along those lines, have you ever had any issues walking into a place with like in full garb? Any issues with security? Any issues with people?
I've had a good track record with that. Actually, I've gotten like free drinks at restaurants because I entertain the host so much by what I'm wearing. I've seen a few people eye me. I mean, I never wear real swords in public. Actually, I frankly don't at LARP events either. I have foam replicas I can use. But no, I've never seen any kind of security risk kind of glances at me.
Well, let's talk about that for a second. You mentioned real weapons, and that segues into something related, which is, do you think some of the lack of proselytizing has to do with the trust issue? If you have all these people, to borrow Nathaniel's phrase, you have two groups of people, vivid imagination, squaring off, and perhaps doubly so in a LARP that has any amount of physical contact combat, which could be, you know, one or two fights all the way up to maybe it's something where it's a boffer LARP and that's all you do. Is there an issue of trust that figures into this that maybe keeps people from just having an open invite to outsiders?
Somewhat. The organization I'm in right now is AntGard, A-N-T-G-A-R-D. It was trying to phonetically be Norse, so the spelling's weird, but anybody can, through the democratic how it's set up, gain access to the coffers, can become in charge of checking weapons, can become in charge of group property and stuff. And there's a little bit of people are hesitant to let newcomers come into power because you frankly don't know if somebody's going to steal. But there's also rules like real steel weapons need to be peace bonded in formal occasions if you're going to wear them. You can't pull them out. They are bound to their scabbard.
I sort of liken that a bit to when you're working with somebody in a theatrical setting, the more you trust somebody, the more that you can get out of it. If you're playing with a group of people that you trust and you feel comfortable with, you're going to have, I think, a more immersive time and you're going to have a more enjoyable time in playing now, but that's not really what you're asking. You're asking about, are there trust issues for newcomers coming in? Was that the question, Dan?
Yeah. Does that figure into why LARPers don't actively proselytize?
I think it might have a little bit to do with it because the unknown quantity that is humanity, you can run up against some dodgy people, and if you get a few dodgy people in your game, it can give you a bit of a headache. I mean, worst case scenario, you have to pop them out, and that's usually bad feelings all around. Or I suppose worst case scenario, you got to call an ambulance, but there's that too.
In the UK, there's something which we call the nanny state, and it's just sort of a state of mind that permeates pretty much everything. So that there is a lot of wariness about people because we don't know them. And then it's not helped by those bad ambassadors who turn up every so often. Some of them, it's just that they are, you know, sort of socially inept, or in the case of, you know, some people, they're the sort of people who put their hands on people in an unwelcome manner. And they think that because it's, you know, role-playing, that you can just do that because it's all in character. It doesn't, in their mind, matter that this girl that they're putting their hands on, you know, outside of her character, not comfortable with that. And that sort of thing does happen, unfortunately, you know, because there's a physical level to the game. Do you get that problem? And some people, basically, you know, have made the issue something that affects all newcomers, because there's always the concern. I know in the back of my mind, I'm always a little bit worried that this guy who I don't know might turn out to be someone who will be putting their hands on some of my female friends. And I'm really quite protective of my friends, so, and I'm not alone in that. So, you know, you do get a default level of mistrust until someone has proven themselves, you know, not to be someone who's going to be doing these untoward things. And unfortunately, that does make it a bit difficult for people to get themselves in if there is this underlying question as to whether or not they're going to be someone you have to be careful of and to watch out for.
So with that in mind, with female players there in character, have any of you ever seen any kind of drama around in-character flirting being misunderstood?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Oh, yes. Yeah, it's to the extent where I refuse to get involved in that sort of level of the game, because someone think that just because I'm flirting with them in character, there's a chance that I actually mean it out of character, and there basically isn't. Because if there is, I'm not going to flirt with them in character, because that feels to me a lot like a bit of a cop-out, where I'm basically doing it in a safe manner because it's in character. There's no personal rejection. And there's a lot of people who do that, so...
If you don't mind me breaking the chronology a little bit, I wanted to comment about your stance of physical contact. It's interesting because I don't really see that in my section of LARP culture, because it's a full contact sport where you're going out there with the expectation that you're going to be hit with at least a foam weapon. Sometimes things go wrong and you might catch a fist by accident. It's all in good intentions. And so I've never really noticed people's aversion to physical contact within my...
I don't think anyone's likely, you know, in a full contact LARP, no one's likely to have a problem with that. I mean, well, accidents happen. Sometimes you clip someone, but it's all in good fun. So the problem is when someone basically has wandering hands syndrome.
That's an issue on the outside of LARPs as well.
Absolutely, but because they're doing it in a LARP, they use the LARP as some sort of safety net. Oh, no.
That grope was in character.
Exactly. Yeah.
Certainly to a lesser extent, but I mean, I've seen the same thing occur within a role-playing game. It's a tabletop game.
I grew up chatting character all the time.
Well, that's completely out of character, and that's also totally hot. That's a completely different issue.
Pat always gets in the way, though.
But, you know, I've seen people in the course of a tabletop game, whether it's verbal flirting or even just some kind of a mental exercise, do something where you can kind of sense, reading between the lines, there's some real issue behind this, but they're doing it with the excuse of, well, my character's doing that, not me. You look at me like, no, you're doing that. Your character is just, it's like, I don't know, a little kid with their stuffed animal. Did you steal the cookie? No, Mr. Fluffy did.
Your character is your courage.
Yeah, precisely.
And that's something that goes on in, if you want to use the term buffer, LARPs more than I've seen anywhere else, because we're not so much roleplay oriented beyond a name and a little bit of a, like an online RP backstory. People generally don't get into character at all. You'll get some people who will act certain ways and claim that they're in characters. You know, the people who are shy in real life but want to act like an ass, that's very common.
The games that I run tend to be 30 people, and everybody knows everybody quite comfortably. You have to have these hands-off rules when you're, you know, you're playing with 300, 400 people. You've got to have a very strong, hard line, because it's very easy for undesirables to creep into such a large game. Whereas with a game, say 30 people in size, where you're all very comfortable, you can get away with challenging some social conventions and maybe even touching upon some taboos if you're going to do it in a mature fashion.
With 30 people, you probably know where people's lines are a little bit better. You're not going to complete strangers at that point.
Yeah. Exactly. And those are the kinds of games that I enjoy, because I like that social exploration and the personal exploration that I can get from it.
I want to ask you guys about the flow of a LARP, because when I go to run a tabletop game, there's a certain process that I go through, which first starts with writing a story. Now, I realize in the Boffer LARP that may not be an issue, because there might be some element that occurs outside of the game of designing these rules or coming up with new scenario ideas of what if we divide people into groups of these proportions and this group has to protect something while this group attacks it or whatever. But story itself really is not an issue. But when I write a tabletop game, I go through the process of writing a story, which in a story-based LARP or a salon LARP is obviously still going to be the issue. When I go to start the game, there's a particular flow I go through, and usually it goes something like, I, as the game master, will start with a piece of exposition. I'll say, okay, you guys are in a space station, and this is going on, and this is going on, and this occurs, and then I'll let them respond to that, whether through role-playing with me, role-playing with each other, and they'll continue it until they declare an action, or the action's winding down such that I need to get involved to referee something or to give a new piece of exposition to keep the plot moving along. You know, okay, something blows up outside. And I'm curious how that goes in a LARP. Do you guys tend to stop the game and do exposition, or do you even as the...
Is there even a GM, or is it more like a story game where everyone's just contributing?
The way I run it, you have to have a storyteller that's sort of in control of the overall plot. And then I have people that come to me and they are sort of out and about with all the other people, and they're letting me know how things are going. What's the mood of the game, of the night? Do we need to inject some more conflict, or are people creating their own conflict? And certainly for the beginning of a game, you don't have to do any exposition as to the location because you're there. And then usually you use an NPC perhaps to sort of spark something off. Or in the case of one game or two games that we did, we used video on YouTube to sort of set the tone and the pace of how we wanted things to go.
How?
Okay, well, say we did one, it was called the Oak Island Mystery, and it was based loosely on the mystery of Oak Island in Nova Scotia, where there's this huge pit and nobody can get into it, and there's theoretically this pirate treasure. So we released a series of four YouTube videos giving a bit of backstory and sort of the rough outline of what we wanted from players. But we did it in the sort of an old-timey newsreel format. And that gave people sort of a heads up on how things were. But when they got there, they were greeted at the door by the butler, and they started talking amongst themselves. And then we had a scheduled event, in which case the unfortunate death of an NPC. and we sort of moved from there. And then I tried to control the situation with all the other people who are helping me run the game by sort of getting a feel for how the game was running. You know, were people interested? Were they engaged? And if they were engaged, then we tried to leave them alone. But if they weren't engaged, then we tried to initiate another event, or we moved the game along, or we decided it's time to serve dinner, or, you know, that sort of thing.
Are those YouTube videos still out there, out of curiosity?
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. But would you mind us linking those in the show notes?
Sure. Actually, I posted them on a previous forum.
There's actually something similar for, there's some YouTube videos out there somewhere. Oh, I think they're YouTube for something called EOS, E-O-S, which is a UK LRP, which does something very similar, or at least did for right at the beginning, where they had videos to give some flavor to the world.
So I'm kind of curious at this point, with everyone out there, everyone interacting, how do you get your story out from there? So you have the death of the NPC initially. Do certain players have information that others don't out there? I mean, are you seeding this information out?
Yeah, definitely, either through NPCs or through players. And the challenge was, at least in this one game, where we gave a number of players the same information so that, say, maybe a couple of them didn't want to spill their guts. One person didn't have the total lock on the information, and people could cut deals, and hopefully they would arrange themselves into power structures and sort of move on from there.
One of the things that I found interesting as we talk about these LARPs is the fact that it almost seems like the term NPC really doesn't fit. Because a true NPC, I mean, of course, the abbreviation is for non-player character. It's a bundle of everybody that isn't controlled by a player, but is instead controlled by a game master who dictates their actions. And when the scene changes focus, that person simply passes out of existence. They have no, I guess to use a psychological term, they have no object permanence. For example, if you guys are in the Color Animal Inn in a D&D game and two characters are role-playing, I might allow one of the other players to play
a
Violet, well, no, I would not. A belligerent drunk in the back of the tavern or something. But the moment that the action focuses back on these two players, that guy ceases to exist. But it seems like that within a LARP, there is no such thing as a non-player character. I mean, you might have inconsequential player characters or background player characters or something else. But if you're doing a fantasy LARP and the main party's up front and I'm simply supposed to be part of the background, whatever character I've assumed continues no matter what these player characters are doing, and you could potentially have a more fun game than what the main party is having. And it seems like that would make these roles, at least for the right type of person, relatively easy to fill.
Yeah, I have a friend who went to one of the large systems in the UK called Maelstrom, and her first event as a player, she didn't really enjoy herself. I mean, there were all sorts of issues, unrelated to the game, which sort of just added up. But she came back as a member of the crew, and she was playing NPCs all the way through the next few events. She had fantastic fun, because you don't get to just play one character. You get to play a whole series of characters, and in their setup at least, they did have a constant character, which they basically brought out for social stuff.
That was actually a question I had, is if everyone comes in with their same character time after time, or if they take different roles each time.
That all depends on the game. There was a game that sadly seems to have disappeared now called Crimson Requiem. It was a post-apocalyptic zombie survival game, basically, with all sorts of strange psychic power type things going on. And we had NPCs who were basically there for the entire event, played by the same members of the crew constantly. They didn't play any other roles for the most part. They were in with the players, and you could not tell in most instances that they were not player characters. In fact, sometimes it had to be pointed out to other players that somebody was not one of the players.
If they're in character the whole time and they're in the same character the whole time, what's the distinction? Why are they considered an NPC then and not
it almost
just a
like,
player character?
It sounds like it's plot significance, and that's really about it.
They are a tool for the crew and the refs. They're given a brief as to what they're trying to achieve, and they're going to try and achieve that through role-playing, and it's to nudge the players in the right direction, or sometimes just to see what the players do. So the people running the game can look at that and go, oh, that's interesting, we can do something with that.
And I think that perhaps also, if you want to sort of look at a clinical definition, an NPC is also not somebody who's going to be getting XP and advancing on. Beyond that, they're pretty much, you know, as Nathaniel pointed out, they're minions of the storytellers.
There's XP and advancement in games like these?
Yeah.
That actually completely surprises me. I would have never imagined.
Michael, what was it you were going to say?
I agree that the NPC aspect is more fun. There's a game called Nero, which really tries to combine the, you have your character sheet and you have your abilities. And, you know, it's the heavy role-playing and tries to combine it with what I do, the combat LARPs. And while I have no interest with the role-playing aspect, whenever I go, I love playing NPCs because I can just go out there and be a part of a story. Basically, my job to die and fight the party. It's a lot of fun. Because I, you know, I get to go in and get to wear a different kind of garb that people want me to wear. Like if I'm a goblin or an ogre, I'll change my fighting style, the weapons I'll use. And it's a lot of stuff that I won't necessarily do with combat LARPs. I get to when I'm playing NPCs.
I want to come back to this whole XP and thing, because this absolutely blows my mind, Dan.
Oh, we won't come back to that. That's what I want to hit next.
Okay.
But I want to lead up to that with another comment slash question, which is, certainly as a tabletop role player, I find that there are some characters I get more attached to than others. And there are some characters that, I guess, draw me in deeper, give me a little more immersion than others. It seems to me like that within a LARP, it would be a lot easier to get attached to your character. And I don't mean this in some crazy Blackleaf kind of way. But here's a character where you're not just playing out a piece of paper. You make this person's costume. You figure out their mannerisms. You, to a certain degree and for a certain amount of time, live out as that person.
You are your avatar. You are your character.
Exactly. And it seems like that would create a real bond or a real sense of expression, I guess, that would be so much more natural between you and your character than what exists in a standard tabletop game.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And that's definitely one reason why I think you have to be slightly more selective about the people you play with, because I consider myself a fairly grounded individual, and I've certainly become attached to characters, you know, not to any sort of psychotic extent, but I can certainly see how if somebody's not particularly grounded that, you know, they could become a little crazy about it. But I think you find that more in games like Vampire and whatnot, where you have an ongoing character that can grow with XP, as opposed to, say, one-shots or, I mean, maybe Michael can sort of clarify. I'm not sure if the more combat-style LARPs have that kind of attachment.
There's two that I'm familiar with, and one more than the other. The SCA, Belgarf, Daggerheer bunch, it's just straight fighting. What I do is Amtgard, my main organization, tries to integrate a little bit more role-playing it by adding in classes. How our XP system works is that you cap out at 6th level. We have multiple classes like Wizard, Scout, Fighter, Paladin. And each week you sign in, you get one credit. And after 13 credits, you become 2nd level. 13 credits later, you become 3rd level. All the way until you become 6th level.
What do you get per level? I mean, what does it actually do for you?
Let's first say for Warrior. 1st level Warrior gets to wear so many points of armor. And how armor works is, you make real armor, and that will let you ignore a certain amount of damage. Say I'm wearing the basic plate mail armor that has a point rating of 6. So I get to ignore 6, just standard sword hits against me, to where it's covering, and then the next one will kill me, if I say hit in the torso. First level warrior gets like 5 lives, which means you die, you can come back 5 more times. Going up a level will give you, okay, now you can wear more armor. Going up more levels, you get more lives, you get the ability to use more weapons like javelins.
Did you say the wizard was one of the classes?
Yes.
How do you do that?
It's unique from the other role-playing LARPs. Like first level wizard, you'll get 10 spell points for first level spells. Now you can break those up, and it's a point buy system for each round you want to play. You can always reset your spell list to get whatever spells you want. You can tie a fabric strip around somebody's sword, and when they hit some armor, instead of it doing 1 point of damage, it does 2, so it can go through armor faster. You can get spells where you point at somebody, yell a bunch of gibberish real fast, and something happens to them, like they're dead, or they have to stand in place for a long time, basically stunned. their spell balls, which are just about softball sized padded balls that, you know, you say some words to charge it up, and then you're able to throw it at somebody.
Lightning ball.
Yeah, exactly. Or fireball, hit somebody instantly dead.
That's interesting. I mean, I would expect that in some of the other type of LARPs we're hearing about. I didn't expect that in more of a combat one, where you're actually making contact with your weapon.
Well, it seems like it would work pretty well, but you'd have to keep it all pretty metagame.
It is. The white ball hits you, you have to know that, that was a nice ball, not to stand for 150 seconds. There is a good bit of metagaming in it.
I can actually confirm that sort of stuff works quite well, because there have been similar systems in use over here that I've had some contact with. As long as everyone's willing to play ball, there is a level of honor required to play it. It's based on an honor system. If you get hit by the projectile, or the rule says that they point at you and it works, or they just indicate an arc and everyone within that arc works, people tend to take it and just go with the flow on that. And this will be happening whilst people are running around and hitting each other with foam swords.
Now, if we talk purely about a boffer sparring type game, something like the SCA, which isn't boffer, but it's still a sparring type organization, mm-hmm. obviously what I'm about to say would not apply. But within tabletop games, we have long espoused that a competitive attitude is generally destructive to the game, that you have to more see this as we are in this together, working as a group to create a good story. And it sounds like that may even be more important in a LARP, because if you have somebody that's in it to win it, that's not just going to cause tension, that's going to lead to cheating, that's going to break down the trust, maybe even start subconsciously encouraging other people to bend or break the rules to compensate for what they perceive as injustice. Do you guys think that's accurate?
Yes, there is an issue we've had within the game. There are people within the organization I'm part of. It's their sole duty to watch the battle and make sure people are taking the hits, obeying the rules of magic. And if they don't particularly see it, it's common practice to tell that person, watch this person. They're not really following the rules. But a lot of it is on your honor.
I'd say that it's a bit of a double-edged sword. I don't think that the competitiveness is in itself a bad thing, because that leads to these fantastic situations where you get two factions, or more, basically sizing each other up because each one, thinks that they be the one that's leading the charge, whatever the MacGuffin they've constructed for themselves is. Whether it's being the leader of an alliance or simply some resources in the game that they want. The competitiveness leads to some fantastic conflict. And as long as it's all kept within the game and people understand that being competitive is all fine and good, as long as you're able to leave that competitiveness at the door and still follow the rules, only good things come from that. And for the most part, people do follow the rules.
Mm-hmm.
As long as they understand that there will be consequences if they're found not be following them. And people tend to be pretty good at working out that these guys here, they're not following the rules. We can't prove it, but we're pretty sure they're not. And if the other players are able to work that out, you can be sure that the ref team will certainly have clocked onto that and be watching them.
There were people certainly in the SCA, and when I played, they had a reputation as people that wouldn't take shots, and people would simply make an effort to swing a little extra hard.
Yeah.
So they'd take it.
That's an issue with a lot of the SCA. The rationale for it is that shot, if with a real sword, would not have penetrated my armor or my skin. That's what the game focuses on, which is one of the reasons why I left, because I'm kind of a skinny guy and I can't really take shots like that physically. They strive towards realism, so they want the two-handed large baseball bat swing to the arm to hack off an arm.
Which, oddly enough, is the opposite of realism.
Yes and no.
So I remember the boffer organization I was in, we actually went to the reverse extreme, where if you brought a new weapon into the game, there was an inspection process it had to go through. But the final step in that inspection process was you had to stand there while a person of the inspector's choice took that weapon and clobbered you with it three times. And
that's fairly standard.
Yeah, if you were not willing to sit there and be hit by your own creation three times, that crap went back in the trunk of your car and should never be seen again. And we did. We had some people that could not go with that they said, there's no way I'm going to let myself be hit by that. And of course, our response was, but you want us to be hit by that. Yeah, no, get it out of here.
It's funny what you said before, Dan. the pipe insulation on PVC, because that's actually how a lot of people start. And certainly how I started LARPing, just getting into the combat. The problem is that you never found anybody who could have put you in the right path.
Yeah, I think that was it, it never went to that next level, that we were out there boffer sparring. As we were boffer sparring, we would start creating these weapons. As we were creating weapons, we'd start researching weapons, and there were little bits and pieces of history or whatnot that I learned through doing that. And invariably, you kind of start to come up with little personality quirks and such. And I think even the group that we were in had a structure. People had roles. For example, near the end, I left the combat and became what they called, if I remember, I was a magistrate, which was basically a referee that I could call stop if somebody was hurt, or I could kick somebody out for cheating or whatever. But it never took that next step to having any kind of a narrative. And nobody came along to me and said, you know what, hey, I'm part of a group that does take it to the next step where it's narrative. I was invited at one point to join the SCA, and I don't want to paint with too broad of a brush here, but at least the people that I had contact with, they were not quite right. And the organization started to worry me. And like I said, I'm not painting with too broad a brush. If you're in the SCA, you may be a great person, whatever. The people I had
not if you're in St. Louis, apparently.
Well, this was also, St. Louis several years ago. This was not yesterday. But, those people, they weren't quite right in the head. I'm like, I can't get involved in this. There's still about another 40 minutes or so left on this roundtable, but this is where I'm going to go ahead and put a break in the show, because I know some listeners like to put our stuff on devices that can only handle 60 to 70 minutes of recording. But since the remainder is not the length of one of our normal episodes, I'll probably go ahead and drop that either tomorrow morning or maybe Monday at the latest. So expect to see that drop simply as a part two to this episode, and then we'll be back the following Wednesday with a regular episode. In the meantime, be sure to check the show notes for a bunch of links that these guys gave me to YouTube videos and other resources, and we will catch you shortly for the second half of this roundtable. This has been a production of Fear the Booth, copyright 2009. Listeners are free to use the show in any non-commercial endeavor, as long as credit is provided to feartheboot.com. You can find previous episodes and other resources at feartheboot.com. Fear the Boot is also a member of the Pulp Gamer Media Network of shows. You can find other great shows in this network at pulpgamer.com.